Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. My name is Lex Shady, along with my partner, Chris Tobin. Before we get started, we'd again like to thank Fire Engineering for this opportunity and you all for tuning in. This month, we had the pleasure of interviewing Battalion Chief Brian Bastinelli from the Harrisburg Bureau of Fire in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Chief will touch on row homes, tactics, training, and more. We hope you enjoy. Welcome back to Main Street Firefighting, a podcast by Fire Engineering. Like I said, my name is Lex Shady, and with me is my partner, Chris Tobin. Joining us today is Battalion Chief Brian Bastinelli with the Harrisburg Fire Department. Thanks for joining us, Chief. Before we get started, can you give us a little background on your experience in the fire service?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be a part of this. I think you guys are doing some great stuff, so it's exciting to be here, so thank you for that. I started in high school as an EMT and then a volunteer firefighter back in the late 80s, and I volunteered at some various departments and various ranks through 2017. And I've been with the Harrisburg Bureau of Fire since 1996, and I currently have the pleasure of serving as a battalion chief on the Delta Battalion.
So can you tell us a little bit about like the culture and history of Harrisburg, kind of about your response, your manpower, some of those things, just to give listeners a little bit of understanding of where you're coming from?
Sure. We are an old northeastern kind of gritty city that started with 16 volunteer fire companies, and over time, the Harrisburg Bureau of Fire, as we know it today, was created from that. Currently, there's about 50,000 people in the city, 11 square miles. About three of that is river, and we have a downtown, an uptown, and an Allison Hill section of the city. Downtown is our high rises. The state capitol is there. We get about 100,000 people during the day that are working downtown. And we cover that with three engines and two trucks. One of the engines is a rescue engine that is our primary rescue response vehicle. And then we have a technical rescue team. We have a box truck, which serves as our heavy rescue. And we're part of the Pennsylvania Task Force One. And we have generally a staffing of about three on each apparatus. So we're somewhere between 15 and 20, low 20s every day, and a command officer. We have some company officers on the various rigs, but not on every rig. We're doing a couple thousand runs a year, predominantly fire responses. We do some AED type medical responses, vehicle accidents, that kind of things. But the balance of our calls is just mostly fire-related responses.
Nice. So what does a response look like for a structure fire for you guys? Does the whole department then respond if you have like 20 guys on duty for the day?
No, we have our tactical box, which was our initial response, is two engines and two trucks and a battalion chief. And then we can fill that out. We'll get the additional remaining engine. So we fill out the first alarm and we get that additional engine. We also get a heavy rescue from the military base to serve as our RIT, and we get an air unit from the county. Yes. And that's our first alarm. Then every alarm after that, we would have department recall, plus we get mutual aid from the surrounding communities.
Do you struggle with getting the department recall and the mutual aid? I mean, has that ever been an issue for you guys?
I wouldn't say that we struggle to get manpower on mutual aid. Obviously, everybody is in the volunteer service is seeing some staffing decreases. We have a couple of companies around us that are staffed pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. So we get a good response from them, but we also have our department recall, so we'll get off-duty guys on call back. So we generally get the manpower that we need. Obviously, everybody would love more manpower, right? But I think we do pretty good with the system the way we have it set up right now.
Sounds like it. So diving in a little bit to the building construction out there, can you describe your typical building stock? I know you have some high rises and stuff too, but what is the primary fire response for you guys? What are you looking at?
So we run the gamut from like lightweight single families through the high rises, through the old state capitol complex buildings. And but our primary response is to 2 and 3 story wood frame and ordinary singles, duplexes, and rows. That's where we see the majority of our work.
So can you talk a little bit about what a row home is exactly and describe the construction? I know they're not super common in the Midwest. They're obviously, you know, the majority out there. So can you describe what that is for us?
Yeah, so our row houses are basically, we have two basic styles of row house. One is a 2.5 story with a, obviously with a peak roof, and then a 3 story flat roof. And they're just interconnected buildings where the B and D walls are houses of very similar look and construction. And they can run the gamut from, the construction is the same. So we have singles that are built like that. We call them duplexes, doubles, twins, whatever. There's just like a mini row. It's just two houses in the row instead of, you know, however many. Our longest row is 24, and we have one that's 16. And interestingly enough, they're on the same block across the street from each other. And then, but our predominantly, we run from 6, 8, 10, 12 is our average row length. Mm-hmm. And they're generally one type of construction. So you'll have a row of 2.5 story wood frames or 3 story wood frames, or 3 story ordinaries is typically what we see our work in.
So what's the biggest hazard that you come across with these row home fires?
Well, I think it depends on what the fire situation is. So we have a lot of combustible exteriors. So you'll have wood clapboard siding, then you might have insul brick over the top of that. And then you might have vinyl siding over the top of that. There's wood porches in the front, wood porches in the rear. So that exterior is very combustible. On the inside, there's at least one open interior stair that serves all 2 or 3 floors. And we have a fair amount of houses that have like a butler stair in the rear. So we might have 2 open interior stairwells. That can be a problem for us. Obviously, there's a lot of void spaces in that type of construction. So we run into issues with fire spread within the buildings. The rows are inherently interconnected. So we see a lot of issues with that. The void spaces traveling from one structure into the other and being connected the entire way down the row. And then in the basement, the basements are unprotected for the most part. So you have exposed joists and potential for balloon frame construction, or at least void spaces that are going to travel up into the structure. And then obviously at the top of the building, you either have knee walls that can be interconnected, or you have the cockloft that can run the entire length of the row. Sometimes we have some firewalls in between there, and sometimes we don't. And then we have, you know, a lot of old buildings. So some of the firewalls, I like to call them fire slower downers, because they don't really serve as a firewall anymore. They're just bricks that have either not been installed properly or have fallen apart. The mortar's degraded over the years, and they really don't do the job that they were put there to do. So I think those are the biggest problems that we run into from a fire spread standpoint. Mm-hmm. It just would depend on where the fire is starting, on which one is the priority at which particular time.
Cool. So yeah, anyone who's ever been out to Pennsylvania knows the row home, right? You know, I mean, it's very endemic to Philadelphia, and it just kind of spreads out from there. But then it does kind of phase out west of, you know, West Virginia. You see a little bit of remnants around Ohio. And by the time you get to Missouri, unless you're in a very old part of Kansas City or St. Louis, you really don't see any row home construction, specifically in St. Louis, because we passed an ordinance after the Great Fire in 1849 to where everything had to have a gangway, which is a space in between buildings. So, yeah, when you go out to Pennsylvania and you see these row homes, it's definitely something that is unique to that state, and I think it definitely requires a entirely different set of tactics and a different strategy when it comes to firefighting. I think a lot of that is reflected in your specific department's way of doing things. So when you get on scene of a row, is there a, like, what's your plan A, B, and C? I mean, depending on what you have, anything from just one unit, because everything is an exposure, right? I mean, that's just, no matter where the fire is at, you're going to have an inherent exposure. And that's something that makes those unique in a challenging way. But just, can you just give us a rundown real fast of kind of what your, I guess, general playbook is for a row home fire?
Sure. So just a little bit about the situation that we're coming into and the exposures. Obviously, we have the row itself as an exposure, and then we have that the upper floors as an exposure. But one of the problems that we have in our city is we don't have a lot of alleys the way that some of the cities do. We do have some. They're not always in the best shape. We can't guarantee that we're going to be able to get vehicles into the rear. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just foot alleys, and some of our rows have no alleys whatsoever, which leads us to a potential exposure issue where we're dealing with a potential fire front on a completely different street. Mm-hmm. You know, in a larger urban city, that might not be as critical as it is for us, but, you know, deploying up to 25 people on more than one fire front can be very challenging. So we like to be aggressive in our firefight. We have a policy in our department, two or more floors of fire, we can lead off with the master stream, but we give our guys kind of the choice to lead off with a large caliber stream whenever they feel they need to. So if there's a lot of fire, we have no problem with them getting up and knocking it down with a deck gun and then following it up with hand lines. We also have step guns with 150 feet of 3-inch off the back of our rigs that we can get those in place pretty quick too. But our default is aggressive interior attack. There's a limited amount of resources. We have to hit hard with the resources that we have, and we have, you know, the potential for significant life hazard. So we need to get in there. So our default, if it's not obvious that we are going to go to master streams right away, then we're going to lead off with hand lines and we're going to do searches. So that might be searching, you know, with the line, searching with the line and then moving beyond them, or do an event enter search from an outside position. But we're going to get two lines in service, most likely in the fire building. And then we're going to start to assign the additional crews into the exposures. Ventilation obviously is pretty critical. So we're getting trucks to the roof as soon as we can, and they may or may not vent depending on the scenario. We have improved over the years our communication between engine and truck, and, you know, having a little bit of tactical discipline on when those windows get taken and coordinating that with our fire tech. But, you know, it's basically down and dirty firefighting. Get lines in the building, get truck companies in there to start opening up and search and try and find the most advantageous spot to say, okay, this is where we're going to stop it and get the resources we need to that point and do that.
Sure. So how big of a problem is attached cock lofts and attics with these fires? Is it something you can kind of expect on arrival, or is it kind of like 50-50 whether it gets out and starts moving laterally?
So there's a couple of ways that the fires will move laterally for us. Interior, obviously the interior voids, So our most of our row houses have three, whatever the higher number of stories is. So basically, if you have a two-story row house, you'll have two in the front and a one-story bump out in the rear, or you'll have three in the front and a two-story bump out in the rear. So you have two separate roofs that have cock lofts. The bump out roof generally covers two buildings, and that's almost always open with no firewall. And then the main cock loft on the top floor of the building, that may run a couple of houses with no cock loft, or I'm sorry, with no firewall, or it may be open for the entire row. So it's hard to tell, but there's a good chance that there's going to be a common void between at least two of the buildings in the row, as far as a roof void standpoint. And then obviously we have air shafts and rear porches, and we can get a lot of fire spread laterally on the outside of the building, in the rear. And then in the front, we generally have either no porch, or we have a porch that's connected down the entire row. And some of those are open. And by that, I mean, you can just look up and see the roof boards, or some of them create a triangle void and they close that off. And that's very often open down the row. And it's open into the joist space between the first and second floor. Or if we have like a bay window, it's open into that space. So you can get a porch fire that gets up into that porch roof, and now it has access to every void space on every floor, and then the cock loft at the top. So it depends where the fire is showing at, but those are our general exterior paths that we'll see, and then the interior voids, and then obviously that interior stairway is a huge fire travel spot. So we have to address those pretty immediately. And you know, it's for us, we definitely look at it and say, we assume that we have fire traveling in those areas first, and then we get to those places, and then we'll start checking them off and say, okay, we're good here, and we move to the next area that's of high priority.
Sure. Yeah, you know, that the servant stairs is a good thing to hit on. Not a lot of people really talk about those. The two main things that come to play for us in St. Louis with those is we do have quite a bit. We call them, you know, servant stairs or butler stairs. Is when you do have a fire in the basement that's basically extending up one end, and then you're coming up the front side. So then you have essentially fire, you know, coming at you from one direction, coming up, you're basically going over to a chimney. That's one set of circumstances. But then another one is when you're searching down one of these hallways and you don't realize that there's stairs back there, and all of a sudden you think you fell in a hole. Well, I mean, it is a hole, but it's just downstairs. And that's something that there's no threshold there, really. It just kind of just goes off. But I've done that a couple times, to where if you don't understand your building instruction, you're just doing a quick search down the hallway, or maybe just even advancing a hose line, all of a sudden now you're falling downstairs because you weren't expecting, you just went upstairs, you weren't expecting to go back down them, you know, at the end of a hallway. So
yeah, and that servant stair, falling down the servant stairs is not exactly like falling down the main stairs.
It's definitely a tight little spiral, very small. Yeah.
They're narrow. They're generally, for us, they're generally wood without any type of carpet or anything over top of them.
Right.
And they'll spiral at some point.
So, but yeah, that's something that a lot of people don't really factor in to their fire spread. Also, incendiary fires. You know, that's something that enough people aren't talking about, is what happens when it's a malicious fire and someone decides to pour both stairwells. That's kind of a whole different set of fire behavior. It's not just one set of stairs on fire, it's two set of stairs, and it's the chimney effect times two, and you know, it's just doubles your problems.
So. Absolutely, and I think it's critical for interior firefighters, company officers, to identify that there is a second set of stairs and communicate that to everybody.
Sure.
You know, we obviously assume that there's an interior stairway, but we don't assume that there's two, but it's something that has to get ruled out. And if it's there, everybody needs to know it's there.
Right. And I'm saying, so I, especially on row home fires, to where, you know, in my case, I'm fortunate to where we can get crews behind a building fairly quick. Our big hindrance is yard gates and that sort of thing. But in the case of row homes, you know, as well as I do, how how challenging it can be to get into the rear. And like you said, if you have a rear set of stairs, just uncontrolled fire rocking up those stairs, and then while you have a set of front stairs on fire, you think that's the main problem, it's going to take you even longer to get back to the rear now. Plus, now you do get back there, you find some rear stairs that have been, you know, someone poured gas on them, and then now you got to get a line back there. Now, how are you getting a line back there? And what's your tactic for rear access in rows? Do you just go through an existing exposure? Do you just try to get whatever you can get back in the alley and just go through a fence? What's your kind of plan for that?
So if we can get apparatus back there, we'll certainly do that. That's probably not going to be, you know, our first engine will lay in to the front of the building. The second engine will pick up their hydrant. So the third engine would be the first one to head to the rear if it's available. Mm-hmm. If it's not, then we are going to do a couple of things. So a lot of our rows are in that, you know, 4, 6, 8 range, mm-hmm. which isn't too far down the street to stretch some additional lines into the alley from around the B or D side. If that's not really available, we'll go straight through the house and out the back, the fire building and out the back, or either the B or D exposure.
Sure.
You know, we have no problem. You know, we're going to run lines in those houses anyway, so we can take one through to get out to the back.
Gotcha. That's a good plan. It's just something that, you know, like I said, I'm fortunate to where we stack all of our apparatus on the front side of the building just because we can get away with it. We have alleys on both sides of the exposure or fire building. That's just, I don't have to deal with that kind of obstacle. Just one more challenge that row homes present. So let's talk about like commercial row homes, where you call them a taxpayer or whatever term you have for them out there. How do those kind of differ other than probably a higher ceiling, I imagine? And then, you know, how do y'all kind of, do you have a lot of those? I know y'all do, because I've been to Harrisburg, but how do y'all kind of, what makes those different than just a standard residential row?
Well, I think that they can be inherently more complicated because of having two separate occupancies. I mean, you can have that in the row house. A lot of our row houses are turned into apartments. But in these buildings, you know that you're going to have that first floor commercial and then apartments above it. So access, obviously, security. A lot of those buildings are deeper than the typical row home. So you need to think about that in your stretch and in your searches and in your air consumption. The backsides are more fortified. Mm-hmm. And then upstairs, we're going to run into a lot more security as far as apartment doors being locked. And you could do that. We got a lot of single room occupancies too. But, you know, we just find that it kind of slows the operation down a little bit because we're forcing more doors. Mm-hmm. And obviously the life hazard can be pretty significant in some of those buildings.
Sure. I'm glad you hit on the stair access, because, and this goes right back to, you know, a Main Street kind of fire strategy, is if you have fire on the second floor or an upper floor of a Main Street building, and we all know how taxpayers are kind of laid out, you don't ever walk into a coffee shop or a barber shop and see stairs, right? The stairs are almost entirely in the rear, or they're off to the side if it's residential. But if you have fire showing upper floor, is it maybe worth sending that first due company to the rear? Because that's, instead of stretching 100-foot of line through the first floor just to turn around into double back, you know, would it be better off sending your first due company before anyone stretches a line to the rear? Because that's probably going to be your most advantageous route for stretching a hand line. And that's something that we see over and over again in Main Street fires that really slows down the fire attack, maybe, if the first due company would have just went to the rear. And ironically, one of the fires which was on Main Street, which we have had on this podcast, which was successful, that's exactly what happened. The first due engine actually stretched from the rear, which is a lot of times where the fire is at, because that's the kind of processes that cause higher fire hazard. Is think about why fires happen. What's in the rear of, you know, these commercial occupancies? It's the kitchens. You know, it's the more hazardous processes that create the fire hazards. You know, it's the smoking lounges. It's that kind of, you know, place where people are doing those things. So in general, the fire is probably in the rear anyways. So instead of wasting, like you said, wasting all your time busting through the first floor through three padlocks, then stretching 100-foot of line on the first floor through who knows what kind of condition just to find the stairs in the rear, just to go back up the stairs to the front, you know, instead of doing all that, which slows everything down, is it worth maybe responding to the rear before you stretch a line? I don't know. It's just a kind of a big what if.
You know, that is a good question, and I could see where it would be beneficial. I'm trying to think of our district. I don't think we really have a lot of places where that upper floor primary access would be in the rear. We mostly have the doors that are off to the side.
Off to the side, sure.
I'm trying to think, but you know, a first floor fire, I would agree with you, is if it's not coming out to meet you, is probably seated in the rear. Mm-hmm. And that might be a very good tactic to consider.
Sure. I think most of those that I'm talking about probably be like on a corner store or something to where, you know, like the right and the left door accessing the second floor, you would have like an address for like a loft apartment or something like that. But generally, now that I think about it, the ones where you're going to find the access on the inside are probably on like the end of a row or like just a standalone or like a corner store to where that side entrance isn't available.
We have a small section of town where for about three blocks on the corner, we have 3 and 4 story buildings that have a commercial space on the first floor and apartments above. And it is only those buildings that I can think of that the actual entrance to the upper floors is kind of a main entrance for them.
Sure.
It's like a little lobby, but that would be at the BC corner on the B side.
Gotcha.
And there's, like I said, there's 3 or 4 of those in our uptown district, but most of our downtown stuff is that front entrance.
Sure. Conversely, I've seen quite a few fires to where people don't understand that those side entrances exist, and you see them go into the main occupancy. You see them going into the first floor looking for stairs, and they're not even in the same building. If they would have, they literally went past the door. You know, it was just right beside. You know, they didn't understand that a lot of second floor accesses have their own door on the front.
Right. And, yeah. That comes from, you know, gathering intel and being familiar with your building stock and getting out and taking a look at this stuff.
And that's the thing, is that's where a lot of Main Street strategy and tactics really it reflects itself in the urban departments in the city, specifically like yours with the row homes, because, you know, like I said before, basically every street in Harrisburg is like a main street. Even the residential neighborhoods, everything's connected. It's multi-story connected, ordinary or old type, legacy 5 construction. So I mean that's Main Street, and I think the tactics that y'all deploy on these are highly beneficial. No, so like go over some of your truck work, because that, I think since there are higher stakes in the game, specifically for a department like yours and the building stock that y'all have, I think truck work is a little more important than other places who may be able to discount truck work because they're not dealing with the challenges like y'all have in your building stock. So just give me like an overview on, so you're assigned to a truck company in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. What's your strategic priorities?
So we generally have 4 on our truck companies. They can go down to 3, and it's complicated. The tractor drawn aerial always has an officer on it, but our tower ladder sometimes doesn't. Most of the time it does, but it, you know, if certain people are off, that space can be filled. You can have 3 firefighters on there. So, but most of the time we try and keep our trucks at 4, and with some of our recent hiring, sometimes we have 5, which is really nice. So we'll just talk about when it's staffed at 4. Most of the guys will split into 2 crews of 2, and 2 of those are going to go interior, and then 2 of them are going to cover the outside and the roof.
Okay.
And then the second truck will come in, and our trucks are really good about talking to each other and getting the positioning down. So our first truck generally goes to the front, and the second truck, if there's access to the rear, they can try and get in there. But generally the first truck will give them some sort of heads up on where they think they should come in from and where they should be going to set up. So perfect. That's a communication that happens pretty much all the time. Cool. When we're responding to building fires.
So
then obviously access to the building is going to be our next priority. So they'll get the building opened up. A lot of those doors that we run into in the row houses are not really that hard to force. Mm-hmm. So that happens pretty quickly most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to start searching. Or they'll, you know, like I said, they'll do a VES, mm-hmm. if the situation calls for that. But search is our highest priority. And then, we'll start ventilating either horizontally or vertically, depending on where the fire's located.
Okay.
But we got to start opening up. Even like our backup guys on the engine companies, mm-hmm. They're always carrying, or should be, always carrying a 6-foot roof hook.
Sure.
And as soon as that line gets the fire knocked down, we have to start opening it up.
Sure.
We don't have the luxury of letting that fire fester in those voids, mm-hmm. because once it gets beyond us, then, you know, then we're really playing catch up, and that's where we can lose. Yeah. It's getting those voids opened up.
It's funny to say that, because I see that reflected a lot in certain departments with older buildings, and even that's the first thing that anyone ever tells you on my department is, you always grab a 6-foot pike pole, no matter what your job is, no matter what you're doing, until you have, new people, always have 6-foot pike poles. We can never have enough. And I understand you might be first in, yeah, you got to, hose work, but still everyone else other than the guy on the tip has a 6-foot pike pole.
If you have a first floor fire and there's, our engine companies are going to have two guys on the line. So if you're controlling the first floor fire, there's a very reasonable expectation that the truck is going to go above you to search.
Sure.
So you've got that floor. And if you just knock the fire down and wait for somebody else to come in and start opening up, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
So, it's as soon as that fire is knocked down and that line is, obviously their priority is, as a backup man, is to get the line in place. And then once they do that, they're going to go right up there and start opening up and keep knocking down, any fire that they find.
Sure. And I think that just goes into a lot of really, good aggressive tactics. And a lot of people I run into it a lot where people say overhaul is boring, overhaul is after the fire. And all that tells me is that you've never fought fire in a lot of old buildings, because me and you both know after the main fire is knocked out is really when the work starts. That's easy stuff.
Overhaul is an aggressive attack tactic in our department.
Especially when the fire starts running on you, or you have multiple fires set by whoever, or things that have extended, like you said, beyond where you expected them to be. You're basically discovering fire for the engine company at that point. It's the roles have flipped, that's, like I said, that's the real work starts. When you have to start, actually overhauling for extinguishment. And
yeah.
That's just something that I see reflected in a lot of legacy departments like that. So now your trucks are kind of split up anywhere between, you said, about 7 to 9 members, depending on your manpower on a fire.
Right.
So go over some roof ops with these row homes and things like that. You send 4 to the roof. Obviously 2 is the minimum, but if you can get more, do you? But what's your general, if you say I need the roof opened up, what's that look like? Are you guys doing trench cuts because they're rows? Are you guys just doing normal, whatever hole you need? How's that kind of working out?
So, not everybody's going to like what I'm about to say, but the roof guy, the guy who's doing the cutting, I mean, it could be just one guy on the roof.
Sure.
We try to not do that, but when you're faced with a significant row house fire, your resources are ate up pretty quickly. So, to operate independently on the roof is something that you absolutely have to be comfortable with. Mm-hmm. We try to get two guys up there. So let's go with a scenario that the fire is up in the cock loft, or it's a top floor fire and we think it's running. The first thing we're going to do is cut a primary vent hole as close to the seat of the fire as possible. And, you know, we don't mess around with our vent holes. If we're putting a vent hole in there, it's going to be big enough to do the job.
Sure.
So 4x6, 4x8, mm-hmm. we're going to make a big vent hole to get that fire vented as best we can. Now, let's back up. First thing they might do, depending on when they get up to the roof, obviously they're going to sound the roof. They're going to look at it and make a determination where they think the best place to cut is. They're going to listen for that engine company. One of the things that I like my engine companies to do is get that water on the fire benchmark transmitted. So as soon as they get water on the fire, they're going to transmit that. And then everybody knows it's game on at that point.
Sure.
One of the things that they might do right then is go to the seaside. Generally on our three-story flat roof rows, on that seaside, there's a window at the top of the steps.
Right.
So it's real nice to pop that window out first. That gets the stairways starting to vent, and then they're gonna go to work on the roof. If you go about 12 to 15 feet back from the front of the building, on the wall where the stairs are. So generally that's the party wall between the two houses. You have your stairs. If you go back about 10 to 15 feet and about 4 feet in from that party wall and put a 4x8 hole right there, you're gonna capture the top of the steps, the upstairs hallway, and part of a bedroom. So that's generally what we like to do, unless the fire is dictating, you know, if it's a front room fire or something like that. But we'll put a nice big hole right there. So our main goal is get that primary vent hole open and then make a decision if we have to start trenching.
Sure.
If you don't make a primary vent hole, obviously when you start your trench, that becomes your primary vent hole. So we like to drill that into guys that we need to get that main hole over the fire open first, and then we can consider the trench. If we can get a second truck company up there, if it's obviously a roof intensive fire, we're gonna shift more resources to the roof. But you know, guys are expected to cut a vent hole, and then if they have to cut a trench, you know, it might be the same two guys that cut that trench. You know, that's a tough day at the firehouse, but you know, they love it. So they might complain about it at the time, and it, you know, they're gonna take an ass beating, but two guys to do all of that throughout the whole fire is not uncommon for us. And we'll get them help when we can.
You hit on like two things that are really, I thought really, really good, which, the first one was, you know, the one guy on the roof, or you even alluded to the two guys on the roof. A lot of people don't realize that's the one of the positions in the fire ground that you're, I wouldn't say you're not, directly supervised. So that's why it requires, you know, not the new kid to do it, right? A lot of truck companies are split crews. We split our truck companies. The rescue squads also split. You know, we don't have a roof officer for the most part in a lot of circumstances. So that you basically got to send someone up there that's a self initiator that understands a little more than just the new person. You're not going to have someone telling you what to do, where to cut, how to cut. That's not for that person to be up there. So that's what people I don't think realize. So you can get away with it with one person or just two, if you have the right guy for the right job or the right person.
Absolutely.
So that shouldn't go without saying that. Also, the other thing you just talked about was the value of your roof opening and how to get more equity out of that roof cut. And how you read your buildings, essentially, you know, how to bump over. Instead of just saying, all right, we're above the fire, we're going to make a hole, you basically said, well, how can I increase the value once I'm over the fire? Now, how can I capture the most rooms, the most real estate with one opening? That is something that, for whatever reason, isn't in any of the books. That is definitely one thing that's been passed down just through an oral tradition of roof work. That's something that the senior guys have definitely taught me and the other members of my department, and that's how we do the same exact thing. We essentially read the vent, the soil pipes on a roof. We bump over a couple feet and try to capture a hallway, a bathroom, and maybe even another room with one hole. And I just thought that was one of the neatest things that works out for me almost all the time. And you basically just said the same thing, but in the context of your endemic building stock. So, and that's something that definitely needs to find its way in a book sooner than later. But I think that's just a great tip for any roof, you know, work whatsoever.
Sure. And when you vent over those stairs, a lot of our row houses have a triangle void over the top of the stairs, mm-hmm. and that's interconnected into the cock loft and the party wall. So you could have a tremendous amount of fire in there, and that's punishing trying to push up those steps when you have that much fire above you. Sure. So getting that void space opened up above those steps is really critical to getting a good line in place on that floor.
So even to split the hair a little more, so what saws, if you don't mind me asking, what's your preferred, do you guys use K-12, like circular saws, or are you on a chainsaw for your line work stuff?
You know, it's been a hot minute since I was on the truck. I was a fan of, we ran the partner 950s mm-hmm. with a Warthog blade on it.
Sure. Yeah.
For flat roofs, that thing is, I really don't like you than anything else.
Okay.
Yeah, however, we have chainsaws and we now have some rotary saws with a bullet blade on it. I don't have a ton of experience using those. They do work. We did some timed tests between them and the Warthog, and there was a difference. Everybody had their preference, but I'm a huge fan of that Warthog blade for those roofs, because a lot of those roofs are built up.
So yeah, flat roofs are generally, we bring the K 970 up there, the circular saw with an aggressive wood blade on there. Those seem to do the job and then be able to go a little longer. We've done chainsaws with flat roofs. They work, but they also put a very big, you know, more of a toll on the saw itself. And just seems like it's not the best tool for the job. The circular saws definitely move a little slower than the chainsaw, but the circular saw is, I think, a little more robust. And as far as mechanically speaking, it's just a better tool for the job. But like you said, all roofs are all built up like that. Multiple layers of tar, depending on how old the building is. Plus, you got your one bys below that. Your plank boards. We're not on OSB. You know, we're not on plywood. So, different ball game on a flat roof like that. So, I was just wondering what you preferred. Because if you bring the wrong saw to the wrong roof, it's just not going to work out for you. So.
Yeah, no, 100%. And like I said, I'm just a big fan of the circular saw with an aggressive blade on it. And, you know, that's what we need because we run into so many layers.
Sure. Tell us about a building that's ever caught you by surprise, you know, or something that you can remember looking back on, that something you missed. Maybe there's, you know, something that you would have clued yourself in on. Looking back on.
So I was thinking about this, and we had a fire, I believe it was back in 2009, early in the morning, for smoke coming out of a wall. And it was the end of a row. And so second floor, end of the row, at the baseboard, there's smoke chugging out of this wall. And we opened it up, and really there was nothing there. Not really any heat. You know, it was a little warm, but not too much heat. So obviously we knew we were remote from the fire, and we started looking for it. We went downstairs, put some holes in the wall there, couldn't find anything, you know, still had smoke. We just couldn't find anything. So I ended up going to the exposure, the B exposure, and went inside there. I shot the ceiling with the camera, and it was pretty interesting. The joist bay, one joist bay, mm-hmm. lit up, mm-hmm. and all the others were not. And it went the whole way across the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So we started looking. We put a hole in there, same thing, smoke. Ended up two houses down. I got to the front door, and there was a little bit of smoke stain on the front door. And so we went in, there was like a little vestibule. There was it had been turned into an apartment. So there was a first floor apartment, and then the main stair, interior stair, goes up to the second floor apartment. So get in there, smells like smoke, nothing really too much. Pushed on the first floor apartment door and see the smoke stain, a little bit of smoke comes out. So I'm thinking, okay, this is where we're at. So call for help, and guys come down, and we force that door, go inside. Sure enough, there's an apartment that had been on fire. It was kind of in a smoldering stage. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up finding a victim in the kitchen. Mm. She had a living room fire and was shuttling water back and forth from the kitchen to try and put it out. And she was semi-conscious on the floor of the kitchen. Yeah. So we removed her, but it was interesting. It took a couple minutes to kind of figure all of that out. A guy was just getting ready to leave for work, noticed some smoke in his house. So he called us, and it got a little bit worse. It had enough pressure, but it basically traveled from one house to the next for three houses. Wow. In a single joist space, and came out in his house. Wow. And there was hardly any smoke anywhere else in any of the buildings.
So that other houses in the middle didn't have any of that smoke showing either?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
The houses in the middle between the fire and where he saw the smoke, there was nothing showing?
No, the only thing that we saw in the houses in the middle was when you shot the ceiling with the thermal imager, you could see that one joist space was much hotter than all the rest of them. Hmm. Once we opened them up, obviously, we had some smoke pushing out, but there was no smoke coming out into any of the other houses. Hmm. So it was pretty confusing for a little bit, because we just couldn't figure out where it was at. And, you know, it sounds, when I tell the story, it sounds like it happened pretty quickly, but, you know, we had to get into those other houses. We had to, you know, you would just keep working our way down the row until eventually we figured out that it's way down here. You know, we checked the basements, we checked the upper floors. So it took a couple of minutes to work through that. So that was pretty interesting, because generally they're, but not in a single space like that. You generally would see smoke travel throughout those voids, mm-hmm. and it would be not under pressure. This was like a little horizontal chimney that went three houses down. It was pretty crazy.
Wow. Yeah. That speaks to the inherent voids that are in these buildings. Clearly that one had been either plastered well, you know, to where it was sealed up that tight. Whoever built that building, you know, knew what they were doing. But,
that's in an area that has gone through some gentrification. Sure. So, okay. It probably played a role in it, having those houses remodeled.
And that's the thing too, is if people either remodel or lay more layers over the previous stuff, those voids become more encapsulated, and then you would potentially see that kind of stuff more commonly than before, to where you might have some cracks in some plaster, it might give you some clues, some smoke would put in. And that's not the case anymore, because someone laid drywall over the plaster. So
right.
So yeah, that's,
we do see that a lot more and more.
So kind of talking about these rehabs of these buildings, what how does that play into your fire attack? Does that cause any additional issues? I'm assuming that adds some more void spaces in places, but have you guys come across anything with that maybe you thought the layout would be one way and then it was remodeled to another and that caused problems, or anything you're finding with the rehabs?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we just had one this week. I was on vacation naturally, so I missed it. but the guys were in a typical row house, you know, three stories, ordinary construction. On the second floor, they had smoke pushing out of the eaves of the rear bump out. They stretch a line up there and they knocked down some visible fire. And the upstairs, as soon as they got to the upstairs, they realized it wasn't like it had, what they typically expected. Generally, you get to the top of the steps, there's a hallway, and it goes to the front of the house, and it goes to the back of the house, and then across from the top of the steps is the bathroom, or very close to there. And so they went towards the rear of the house. They knocked down some fire. They said they had the fire knocked down. The battalion chief that was working was doing a 360, and he's like, "I got fire showing on the seaside. I don't think you have the fire." And what they had found was pretty much the hallway had been taken away, so the rooms in the front of the house were made a little bit bigger because they removed the hallway. Mm-hmm. But the rooms in the back of the house were actually split further. So they took one rear bedroom and made it into two rear bedrooms. So there is a door diagonally opposite from where they came in. So say they came in on the left side of the room, mm-hmm. the door to the very end bedroom was on the right side of the room. So it had bunk beds and a bunch of stuff in there. So it took them a while to get through that and access that rear door. They thought they were in the rear room of the house, but here it had been split into two rooms, and then there was fire in that back room at the very back. So, you know, we're starting to see some of that kind of stuff. You know, they're putting more and more people are living in these houses, and they're making modifications either on their own or, you know, turning them into single room occupancies. And we're also starting to see, you know, a proliferation of like lightweight materials mixed in mm-hmm. with our legacy building. So you can no longer just assume that the building is going to perform the way you expect it to, because these materials are starting to get mixed in.
Sure.
And it's going to act a little bit differently than what you would just think it would if it was the straight legacy construction.
Sure. So now, what are some things that your department does from the academy onward as far as getting your membership up to par on the building construction?
So building construction, I think, is part of our culture in our department. We talk a lot about it, and it does start in the academy. There is actually, the chief of our department teaches the building construction portion of our fire academy, and they actually load up in buses and get around town and do some walk and talks and look at different types of construction. So that starts from the very beginning as far as our training is concerned. And then each of the shifts does it a little bit differently, but, you know, building construction, getting out, looking at buildings, that kind of stuff is really ingrained in what we do. On our shift in particular, we have a company drill program that we run. So we have some basic task level drills that are done at the company level on a rotating basis. So like one day is engine day, one day is truck day, one day might be rescue day. But we have in that list of rotating, so you go through that rotation about 1.5 times a month. And one of those things is building construction. So basically what the drill is whatever you want it to be as the company officer, but it has to be on a building construction topic. And then another one that we do is a building card. And we basically make the 5x7 cards up, and they have like location information, occupancy type, number of floors, construction type, special construction features, stair locations, utility locations, FDC alarm, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff on there. So basically the company goes out on that particular drill day, finds a building and completes a card, you know, walks around, gets as much information as they can, completes that card, and then they bring it back to the station. And we keep those in a box. So then you have another built-in drill where you can just pull a card out of the box and say, hey, tell me about this building and what do you know about it? So that comes up in that rotation, you know, like one or two times a month that they're out doing that. And like I said, then we have a building construction day. We also have some after action reviews built into that rotation. So with those, you know, often a good after action kind of dives into building construction as part of the report. So we have like three or four opportunities each month where building construction is built into that drill program. And then whatever happens to be on the department training schedule on top of that. But it's something that we're, you know, we've obviously understand that it's crucial to how we operate, and you know, fire behavior, building construction, if you're not hitting those on a regular basis and you don't understand the interplay between those and how your actions affect both of those things, you're probably not going to be as effective as you hope to be. So we hit those pretty hard, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think it goes to say, especially like the departments in Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, older part of the country, it seems like when we go out there and teach, I've noticed that the departments are a lot more heavily invested and engaged in the firefighting side of what we do. And you don't really see the mission creep that you see in the Midwest, to where, you know, we're busy doing a lot of EMS, a lot of non-fire related runs. It just seems like in your neck of the woods, the firemen are a little more of actual firemen. I don't know how to better, you know, put that in any other context, but I have noticed that just from being out in, you know, in your area, that it just seems like it's not a problem where you're at. It's just more of just part of the job, to where when you get out here in the Midwest or even other parts of the country that are newer, I think people discount a lot of the building construction, just because the buildings are either, well, they're it's not much of a firefight once you get there, or the buildings aren't there on arrival, or the fires just aren't happening at a rate to where they see these things as important as maybe you do or I do. So I think all that comes back to the older buildings that you have in your city, and that's just a trickle-down effect of really knowing what you need to know to be a good fire department. And I think that's probably why, as far as everyone we've interviewed, probably you have the most put together building construction program and plan that we've talked to so far, other than just, you know, your walkthroughs, your you know, your inspections, if y'all even have those. Do y'all ever get inside vacant buildings and train, or do you have a list of vacant buildings, or you just kind of find one and go do your own thing?
We do have a list of vacant buildings. There's a ton of vacant buildings in our districts, and we do get out there. We do have a good relationship with the codes department and with housing, and they do let us know when there's buildings that we can train on. We actually have an internal truck academy that we put our guys through, and that is a week of almost exclusively working in vacants, you know, kind of dissecting those buildings and doing a lot of roof work, a lot of opening up and overhaul and learning those. So we try and hit the vacants really hard when they're available. They're not always available. Sure. And you know, so we take advantage of it when we can.
And man, I mean, that just speaks volumes of anyone could go on YouTube and just search your department, see the performance level. And it's those small things that really goes a long way. And it's like, basically what you're seeing isn't an accident, right? That is by design. And that's a lot of people, I don't think, understand when you do get access to a vacant building, you know, they don't know how to best utilize that vacant building to the fullest potential for training in their department. Because some places, depending on where you work, if you work in a nicer, newer community, vacant buildings may be non-existent. And when one does come around, a lot of the departments don't know really how to use it to the best potential. So the fact that you, first of all, have access, you have a rapport with someone who can set you up for those, and you took it one step further to basically have a formal program that utilizes those to the best potential. That's probably, I mean, it's not probably, it's why, you know, you're able to do the things you are able to do on scene with minimal risk. So, I mean, anyone out there listening, I would say if they want to see a department that kind of does it right in that aspect, I would say look at Harrisburg. We do something very similar with our vacants. We can go to the city, they have a list for us. Every academy class, recruit class spends almost a full week inside the buildings before they graduate, doing nothing but overhaul and then roof work, and we just kind of step it up from there. And then the companies can go out in their still districts and their areas and then access the vacant buildings at their disposal, and the officer can set up any type of training that they deem fit. So yeah, I mean, that's just something that's really, really, really good and beneficial for anyone to do that has the access to the vacant buildings. So, but yeah, moving on, what resources do you recommend for individuals wanting to study building construction more than maybe what they have access to on their department, other than just a computer screen?
Well, I think you have to start first with your senior personnel. talk to the senior man who's been there in that district and worked there and, you know, pick their brain. Talk to the firemen that you work with that have building trade knowledge. We have a guy in our station that is a contractor, and you know, he grew up in the city. He's a contractor, and he's a wealth of knowledge for us. You know, talk to those people because they have a lot of experience and understanding of the nuances of the different types of buildings, and they have that construction background and the fire experience. So that's where I would start first. Obviously, there's podcasts like you guys that are great. There's also some stuff out on YouTube. You know, just vet who you're paying attention to. Just because they're out there doesn't necessarily always mean they're putting out great information. So I'd vet it a little bit. But there's a lot of stuff online that you can do. There's a ton of good books that are out there, and I keep finding more and more books. I think the obviously the ones that we know, the Collapse of Burning Buildings, Brannigan's book, like those are great starting blocks. But then you can go to other books like Francis Ching, Building Construction Illustrated. That's a really good book. You know, for row houses, there's the New York City Row House Manual. Philadelphia has a Row House Manual. They're a little bit more historical, but they talk about rehab and different things like that. Harrisburg has a Historical Homes Manual that's online that gives a lot of good information. And then there's books like The Baltimore Row House is a great book by Marilyn Hayward and Charles Belfour. That's a good book of the history of the Baltimore Row House. Pretty much anything you could want to know about those. So, you know, just keep looking for that kind of stuff that's out there and talk to people, go to classes and expand your horizons. Don't just, you know, read the basics on building construction. There's so much more to it than that.
Sure. And I mean, I like how you said, you know, you point out to the nuances. It's really good to be able to tap into a resource that can say, hey, all the houses in this neighborhood have rear stairs, or, you know, this portion of the city, there's this particular thing about the buildings that the other portions of the city don't have. It goes almost beyond the buildings, and it sets you up for a little more of success. It kind of sets you up with a broader spectrum of your perspective. But that's definitely a good thing to look at. And like you just said, you know, walking through the buildings, getting in the buildings, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, teaching building instruction in a classroom is like teaching swim lessons in a gym. You know, I mean, it's that you got, you can't, right? You eventually have to get into the environment of what you are speaking about. And that's where I
think you have to pay attention to your neighborhood. Like take the pulse of your neighborhood. It's constantly changing.
Sure.
So, you know, get out there and see what's happening. Look for construction dumpsters, see who's doing modifications to houses, what they're doing. Ask them if you can go in and take a look. Most people don't, you know, if you show up on the fire truck, most people don't question that, and they'll let you, you know, take a look or answer your questions. But you got to get out there. It's not going to come to you.
Sure.
Until it's on fire. So get out there ahead of time and check this stuff out, and, you know, make notes and pass it on. That's probably the biggest thing, is if you find something, don't hoard that information, pass it on to other people. You know, we're getting these houses, so like our legacy houses are 100-150 years old. Obviously we're further and further away mm-hmm. from the people who operated in them, you know, like during the war years, that kind of stuff, where they were going to fires all the time. Like, we don't have as many of those people around anymore. Mm-hmm. So get that information before they're gone, because we keep getting, you know, generations and generations away from really good working knowledge of these buildings. So we have to pass it on. So if you have the information, share it. If you don't have the information, go out and find it.
Sure.
That's awesome. So I reached out a couple people and asked if they had any like kind of questions that they would want to hear from you specifically. One of them is, tell us about your yard board. How do you use it specifically, and how do you use it during inclement weather?
I'm sorry, my what?
The command board.
Yeah.
Oh, the command board. I'm sorry. I never heard it called a yard board before. So we have a command board that is made by a company called American Trademark. It is obviously dry erase. We use a passport accountability system. Mm-hmm. And then I have a sheet that I use on my clipboard that I start with. So it has it. I can run like a first alarm fire off of that sheet, and then I move into accountability and doing a drawing of the incident scene, stuff like that, onto that board. We use it mostly to do our accountability tracking. Sometimes, so I have one in the BC car, and then each of our deputy chiefs has one, so we can get multiple boards up and running pretty quick. But we'll get I like to have either EMS or the police go around and collect the pass tags and get the board set up for me. Mm-hmm. And then by the time I get my 360 done and we get the initial operation going, it's there. Okay. And I can start organizing it. And then we just use it to track when we go to a greater alarm fire and those additional officers, chief officers come in, they'll take a role in, generally they'll take over, like one of them will take a forward position and one of them will take accountability and run that on the board so that somebody's paying attention to the fire as well. Gotcha. That's kind of how we use it.
Okay, cool. So another person asked, you've heard the phrase, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. They wanted to know what your thoughts on that. Do you think that's true for, fire ground skills and knowledge?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, doing, task level drilling is critical. So, you go through the academy, you learn how to do all of the stuff, you come out to the street, you kind of relearn the street way of doing all that stuff. And then generally about like 3 or 4 years on the job, guys will start to coast a little bit. And, like I'm going to calls, I'm doing this stuff. I know that. I learned all that. But you learn how to do it. You may not have learned, we use the word nuance again. Mm-hmm. You may not have learned all of the nuances of how to be effective with whatever skill set we're talking about on the street and in different scenarios. So I like to put emphasis on the task level skill stuff. So stretch a line, throw a ladder, force a door, do a search, that kind of stuff. That's what companies should be drilling on. And that's what I kind of push out for our companies to do their company drills on, is that basic stuff. Keep it fresh and keep it in everybody's mind and continuously improve it. And then if you have that stuff down pat, then it's not going to be a problem for you on the fire ground. So I don't necessarily want you having a discussion with your partners about how you're going to throw a ladder or who's going to stand where. Like that, the action of getting the ladder off of the truck and throwing it to the building should just happen. Mm-hmm. Because you've drilled on it, you've worked it out, you know ahead of time what you're going to do. Then what I want at that point is you guys looking at that building and saying, oh, there's 3 or 4 people up there. That guy's got to go first. And understanding why you're triaging those people the way you are. Like, I don't want people using brain power on basic skills. That should just be the way it should just be happening.
Right.
So I think it's critical that we keep that basic stuff fresh all the time. And you will lose those skills if you don't. I mean, you can go to any fire ground and see that firsthand.
Cool. And then the last one, I told him I would ask, but you can't say it's him because it came from him. But Yonkin wants to know who your favorite LT is.
Naturally, my favorite LT is Lieutenant Brian Yonkin on Tower 1.
There you go. Well, he'll get a bigger head after that one for sure.
I haven't seen him in a hot minute because he's been acting captain because of somebody being off. So I think we work in the same station, so he'll be back in September, I think, just in time for me to go on vacation. So we might not really actually work together in the same firehouse until like October.
Oh, wow. He's going to go through withdrawals pretty soon.
I hope so.
So just wrapping it up here, we really appreciate your time. This is a great conversation. So we're really looking forward to people hearing this. If someone wanted to reach out to you for more information on the stuff that was discussed today, or see some of the information you share online, you know, from the videos to your construction posts and all of that stuff, would you mind kind of sharing where people can find you at?
Sure. On social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, actually even YouTube, it's just Brian Bastinelli. So search up my name and you'll find me there. You can find me through the Firemanship Journal website, which is a new website that Brian Yonkin and I started related to the Firemanship Journal. You can email me, brianbastinelli@gmail.com. And then if you do one of those things and we start talking, then I'll give you my phone number and we can chat. It's much easier to do that. But that's generally, I'm out there. If you just put my name in, you can find me somewhere.
Perfect. Well, like I said, we really appreciate your time and this was a great conversation. For the listeners, we'll throw some photos up of some of the stuff that Brian was talking about and kind of link his social media too for that to be a little bit easier for you guys to find. But thanks again, Brian. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was great. I've been looking forward to this for a while, so thank you.
I see you, Brian.
Take care, Chris.
Please be sure to reach out to Brian on social media, as his knowledge of building construction and firefighting tactics is a resource we are all lucky to have. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Main Street Firefighting, a podcast on fire engineering. Have a great night.